Color Theory, written by Wolfraven80 and read by Wilfriede0815. Fandom, this is how you lose the time war. Relationship, blue/red. Summary. In between more ambitious ventures, Blue and Red take tea in London. But even when braiding the strands, Blue always makes time for letters. This is not Blue's favorite London. Currently, it would be ill-advised to venture there if she and Red wish to stay out of the reach of their former comrades. And since they both enjoy remaining alive and at large, they keep to the fringes, far from the front lines. So this London is a peripheral one, without the Dickensian charm of taffeta and top hats, and all the realities of chimney sweeps and child labor. The steeples are blackened with coal dust, which often mixes with the autumn mist to settle on the streets like a choking pall, commonly called a pea super, thanks to the yellowish quality of sulfur dioxide. Blue systems are self-repairing, much like Red's, though the mechanisms are different, so neither so much as sniffles as they navigate the smog-choked streets to a tea house just off Piccadilly. They step out of the toxic mist and into the, equally oppressive, oriental splendor of the Greenleaf Tea House. The walls are plastered with inky monochrome prints of plum trees and lotus flowers with spatters of calligraphy that cut off mid-verse and merge with unrelated passages, creating comically mismatched poems about the midnight moon falling like spring rain. Their tables, China, with its rice paddy farmers and their conical hats, was fired in Korea, and the Ming vase in the corner, in Vietnam, but Blue and Red say nothing of this to the hostess. After all, a lovely pair of young society ladies, as they appear to be, would hardly know the difference between such far-flung lands. Their guest, a certain Miss Springer, arrives with her handkerchief pressed over her nose and mouth, and alternately coughs and apologizes until the server arrives to pour the tea. The teapot is poised above Red's waiting cup when another pair arrives, hacking, into the embrace of the tea house, and Blue waves a hand.
"Oh, my dear Miss Baker, how lovely to see you here. You must join us."
Red chimes in with an elegant, "Yes, please do," and Blue can see the glint of triumph flicker across her features. She lets her arm accidentally brush against Red's. Flirtation on the job was strictly prohibited by Red's agency, so Blue makes a point of engaging in it at every opportunity. On principle, Red hasn't objected. Miss Baker and her brother, the eminently available Mr. Baker, join them, and Blue makes all the introductions as the server pours, the verdant green settling in their cups like a reminder of Garden's smothering embrace. Escaping from Garden and the agency isn't enough, so they return to work, their own work. They start far up Thread, making only the smallest alterations. A whispered word, a veiled suggestion, an unexpected introduction. Red has learned patience from Blue, the art of grafting herself to the Thread, and they appear often as sisters, sometimes as the embodiment of the Muses, or as something more, rescuing, or inspiring, Sappho's fragments. Together, they begin to bind together the two solitudes that birthed Garden and the agency, the braiding of them not either or, but and. And then, one lifetime's task accomplished, they return to some version of London to make an accounting of their work and calculate the vectors for their next venture. In this London, green tea has superseded black thanks to a wave of interest in the Far East. It leans more towards cultural fetishism than any real enmeshing of cultures, but a few more tweaks, and a new thread might sprout where fashionable Londoners read the Tao Te Ching alongside Dover Beach. In the meantime, Blue sips her tea and makes careful conversation, whereupon it's discovered that Miss Springer and Mr. Baker share a love of Tennyson and delight the entire company by reciting by rote their favorite passages. Red and Blue urge them on, asking if they've read his latest work. They have, naturally, and expound upon it at length. Within the hour, Blue is confident they've done their work well. And though this was an easy job, an afternoon's work rather than a lifetime's, she takes pleasure in it. They've avoided an undesirable marriage, that of Miss Springer and a certain coal baron who will now marry another young lady who, sadly, will never produce a son. Unable to pass his vast empire to a male heir, the reins of the Coal Baron's company will instead go to a nephew much interested in new technology. The company will eventually pioneer geothermal power generation. It's but a tiny nudge, one that balances upon the razor's edge between Garden and the agency. Before the party begins to say their goodbyes, Blue produces a small tin from her pocket and cracks it open to reveal boiled sweets, striped ochre and brown. She holds the tin up to Red.
"You must try these," she says, her tone buoyant as she offers her best socialite smile. "They're new humbugs from that delightful little confection shop down the street. Caramel and mint flavored."
She nudges one towards Red, who smiles and takes the proffered humbug with only the very slightest rise of her eyebrows. After all, Red knows her too well not to suspect. The other ladies accept a hard-boiled, the gentlemen decline. And then the party disperses into the still smoggy late afternoon. Red sucks on the humbug and allows the words to melt across her tongue. My dearest fruit of the underworld, how do I love thee? Let me enumerate the ways. Like a wolf her teeth when chasing after prey, like a blade its tempered steel with enemies to slay, like a bee its pollen brought back for the hive, like a down-thread ship its hyperdrive. Pardon the rhyming. I've read far too much period poetry in preparation for today's luncheon. Idylls of the King is all well and good, but I'm sure no one ever wished it to be longer. I am longing for our next foray upthread. How will we remake ourselves? Shall we dance among the bacchanals? Or sail the Nile to Napata? Or stroll the boulevards of Tenochtitlan? I will love you in every age on earth, dear Red, on every plain and mountaintop and the surface of every star. When, someday, we can dare a jaunt down thread. I will paint the world in every shade of violet, plum, aubergine, and mulberry. I will grow for you a crop of strange pomegranates and water them with my blood and, in doing so, with yours, until they turn a perfect shade of amethyst. This is how we win. Love, Blue. P.S. I've arranged a little surprise for you, if you'll oblige, and turn back onto Piccadilly, westward. They cannot touch each other here, in the streets of London during Victoria's reign, but as Red sucks on the last syllables of Blue's letter, she revels in the nearness of Blue, the tantalizing closeness, the filament of time and space that binds them together even when no one can see. As a child, she'd striven to experience solitude, to be, for a few hours, a discreet being, apart from the network she'd been born into. And in that solitude, Blue had saved her, made her. In seeking solitude, she had found another self. Without that seeking, she would never have become a part of Blue, and Blue a part of Red. Without being prompted, Red turns down Piccadilly. The smog has thinned a little, resolving into gauze-like haze. In the west, the sapphire sky is being painted in shades of violent scarlet by the sinking sun. But as the haze swirls around the horizon, it transforms the scene, smudging the dusky shades into something else. It melts and melds into a new palette, painting a tableau that is neither blue nor red, but a brilliant, effusive mauve. The End.